happening as we get into the rest of the week that will be happening in relation to the congressional fight that Obama will be having. And he will have quite many issues with Congress. So this is the orchestral sort of display going on now as we wait for Obama to step up and begin this process of the inaugural. And we can still take your comments at 651-646-8255, toll-free 877-615-1500. I can read the list of promises. That would be fun. Here's another thing that I didn't mention yesterday, didn't get a chance to. In the midst of all of this, Charles Rangel, the congressman from New York, will be planning to introduce his controversial legislation to reinstate the draft again this year. Now, I don't know how far it will get in Congress, but he says he'll reintroduce it until right after the he'll wait to reintroduce until after the economic stimulus is passed. Yesterday, you may have heard about the Obama Corps, the people that will be out stumping for Obama after he becomes president. The Obama Corps will be getting free coffee. If you join the Obama Corps, you'll get free coffee from Starbucks. It was announced yesterday. I think that's a great one. This is odd. I feel like I'm tripping here. This is odd music today. Here's another one. Bill Ayers was turned away from Canada by immigration officials yesterday. You remember Ayers was the guy who everyone big controversial political issue during the political campaign about Ayers. It never stuck. Him being the SDS revolutionary that bombed the Pentagon and a supporter of Obama. Ayers had been invited to speak before the center, and he was scheduled to meet with the Toronto District School Board, and then he was basically thrown out of Canada. All right, enough of that. This is Dianne Feinstein. Let's go on with the inaugural process here.
Who will administer the presidential oath of office.
At KSTP, St. Paul, Minneapolis, the talk station.
Just in the last few moments, the White House website has changed. It now recognizes Barack Obama as
just
president.
What we need to know.
Moon has passed in the east. He is president of the United States.
Not yet.
And doesn't seem as if he can believe it himself.
Prepared to take the oath, Senator?
I am. I, Barack Hussein Obama, do solemnly swear
that I will execute the office of President to the United States faithfully.
That I will execute
the office of President of the United States.
The office of President of the United States faithfully.
And will to the best of my ability.
And will to the best of my ability.
Preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States.
Preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States.
So help you God.
So help me God.
Congratulations, Mr. President.
So there it is. He's President Obama. There you go. Now, what we'll do here is we will cover the inaugural. In other words, we will air the inaugural speech. And then if we have time, we'll take reaction to it. Obama's just standing there. People are applauding. Live pictures all over the world. And people there at the Capitol standing before the now President of the United States, Barack Obama.
What a moment for the man, and what a moment for the country.
It is my great personal honor to present the 44th President of these United States, Barack Obama.
My fellow citizens,
I stand here today humbled by the task before us, grateful for the trust you've bestowed, mindful of the sacrifices borne by our ancestors. I thank President Bush for his service to our nation. As well as the generosity and cooperation he has shown throughout this transition. 44 Americans have now taken the presidential oath. The words have been spoken during rising tides of prosperity and the still waters of peace. Yet, every so often, the oath is taken amidst gathering clouds and raging storms. At these moments, America has carried on not simply because of the skill or vision of those in high office, but because we, the people, have remained faithful to the ideals of our forebears and true to our founding documents. So it has been, so it must be with this generation of Americans. That we are in the midst of crisis is now well understood. Our nation is at war against a far-reaching network of violence and hatred. Our economy is badly weakened, a consequence of greed and irresponsibility on the part of some, but also our collective failure to make hard choices and prepare the nation for a new age. Homes have been lost, jobs shed, businesses shuttered. Our health care is too costly, our schools fail too many. And each day brings further evidence that the ways we use energy strengthen our adversaries and threaten our planet. These are the indicators of crisis, subject to data and statistics, less measurable, but no less profound, is a sapping of confidence across our land, a nagging fear that America's decline is inevitable, that the next generation must lower its sights. Today, I say to you that the challenges we face are real. They are serious and they are many. They will not be met easily or in a short span of time. But know this, America, they will be met. On this day, we gather because we have chosen hope over fear, unity of purpose over conflict and discord. On this day, we come to proclaim an end to the petty grievances and false promises, the recriminations and worn-out dogmas that for far too long have strangled our politics. We remain a young nation, but in the words of Scripture, the time has come to set aside childish things. The time has come to reaffirm our enduring spirit, to choose our better history, to carry forward that precious gift, that noble idea passed on from generation to generation, the God-given promise that all are equal, all are free, and all deserve a chance to pursue their full measure of happiness. In reaffirming the greatness of our nation, we understand that greatness is never a given. It must be earned. Our journey has never been one of shortcuts or settling for less. It has not been the path for the faint-hearted, for those who prefer leisure over work or seek only the pleasures of riches and fame. Rather, it has been the risk-takers, the doers, the makers of things, some celebrated, but more often men and women obscure in their labor, who have carried us up the long, rugged path towards prosperity and freedom. For us, they packed up their few worldly possessions and traveled across oceans in search of a new life. For us, they toiled in sweatshops and settled the West, endured the lash of the whip, and plowed the hard earth. For us, they fought and died in places like Concord and Gettysburg, Normandy and Quezon. Time and again, these men and women struggled and sacrificed and worked till their hands were raw so that we might live a better life. They saw America as bigger than the sum of our individual ambitions, greater than all the differences of birth or wealth or faction. This is the journey we continue today. We remain the most prosperous, powerful nation on earth. Our workers are no less productive than when this crisis began. Our minds are no less inventive, our goods and services no less needed than they were last week or last month or last year. Our capacity remains undiminished. But our time of standing pat, of protecting narrow interests and putting off unpleasant decisions, that time has surely passed. Starting today, we must pick ourselves up, dust ourselves off, and begin again the work of remaking America. For everywhere we look, there is work to be done. The state of our economy calls for action, bold and swift, and we will act, not only to create new jobs, but to lay a new foundation for growth. We will build the roads and bridges, the electric grids and digital lines that feed our commerce and bind us together. We will restore science to its rightful place and wield technology's wonders to raise healthcare's quality and lower its cost. We will harness the sun and the winds and the soil to fuel our cars and run our factories. And we will transform our schools and colleges and universities to meet the demands of a new age. All this we can do. All this we will do. Now, there are some who question the scale of our ambitions, who suggest that our system cannot tolerate too many big plans. Their memories are short, for they have forgotten what this country has already done, what free men and women can achieve when imagination is joined to common purpose and necessity to courage. What the cynics fail to understand is that the ground has shifted beneath them, that the stale political arguments that have consumed us for so long no longer apply. The question we ask today is not whether our government is too big or too small, but whether it works, whether it helps families find jobs at a decent wage, care they can afford, a retirement that is dignified. Where the answer is yes, we intend to move forward. Where the answer is no, programs will end. And those of us who manage the public's dollars will be held to account to spend wisely, reform bad habits, and do our business in the light of day, because only then can we restore the vital trust between a people and their government. Nor is the question before us whether the market is a force for good or ill. Its power to generate wealth and expand freedom is unmatched. But this crisis has reminded us that without a watchful eye, the market can spin out of control. The nation cannot prosper long when it favors only the prosperous. The success of our economy has always depended not just on the size of our gross domestic product, but on the reach of our prosperity, on the ability to extend opportunity to every willing heart. Not out of charity, but because it is the surest route to our common good. As for our common defense, we reject as false the choice between our safety and our ideals. Our founding fathers, faced with perils that we can scarcely imagine, drafted a charter to assure the rule of law and the rights of man, a charter expanded by the blood of generations. Those ideals still light the world, and we will not give them up for expedience's sake. And so, to all the other peoples and governments who are watching today, from the grandest capitals to the small village where my father was born, know that America is a friend of each nation and every man, woman, and child who seeks a future of peace and dignity, and we are ready to lead once more. Recall that earlier generations faced down fascism and communism not just with missiles and tanks, but with the sturdy alliances and enduring convictions. They understood that our power alone cannot protect us, nor does it entitle us to do as we please. Instead, they knew that our power grows through its prudent use. Our security emanates from the justness of our cause, the force of our example, the tempering qualities of humility and restraint. We are the keepers of this legacy. Guided by these principles once more, we can meet those new threats that demand even greater effort, even greater cooperation and understanding between nations. We will begin to responsibly leave Iraq to its people and forge a hard-earned peace in Afghanistan. With old friends and former foes, we will work tirelessly to lessen the nuclear threat and roll back the specter of a warming planet. We will not apologize for our way of life, nor will we waver in its defense. And for those who seek to advance their aims by inducing terror and slaughtering innocents, we say to you now that our spirit is stronger and cannot be broken. You cannot outlast us, and we will defeat you. For we know that our patchwork heritage is a strength, not a weakness. We are a nation of Christians and Muslims, Jews and Hindus, and non-believers. We are shaped by every language and culture, drawn from every end of this earth. And because we have tasted the bitter swill of civil war and segregation and emerged from that dark chapter stronger and more united, we cannot help but believe that the old hatreds shall someday pass, that the lines of tribes shall soon dissolve, that as the world grows smaller, our common humanity shall reveal itself, and that America must play its role in ushering in a new era of peace. To the Muslim world, we seek a new way forward based on mutual interest and mutual respect. To those leaders around the globe who seek to sow conflict or blame their society's ills on the West, know that your people will judge you on what you can build, not what you destroy. To those who cling to power through corruption and deceit and the silencing of dissent, know that you are on the wrong side of history, but that we will extend a hand if you are willing to unclench your fist. To the people of poor nations, we pledge to work alongside you to make your farms flourish and let clean waters flow, to nourish starved bodies and feed hungry minds. And to those nations like ours that enjoy relative plenty, we say we can no longer afford indifference to the suffering outside our borders, nor can we consume the world's resources without regard to effect. For the world has changed, and we must change with it. As we consider the road that unfolds before us, we remember with humble gratitude those brave Americans who, at this very hour, patrol far-off deserts and distant mountains. They have something to tell us, just as the fallen heroes who lie in Arlington whisper through the ages. We honor them not only because they are the guardians of our liberty, but because they embody the spirit of service, a willingness to find meaning in something greater than themselves. And yet, at this moment, a moment that will define a generation, it is precisely this spirit that must inhabit us all. For as much as government can do and must do, it is ultimately the faith and determination of the American people upon which this nation relies. It is the kindness to take in a stranger when the levees break, the selflessness of workers who would rather cut their hours than see a friend lose their job, which sees us through our darkest hours. It is the firefighter's courage to storm a stairway filled with smoke, but also a parent's willingness to nurture a child that finally decides our fate. Our challenges may be new. The instruments with which we meet them may be new. But those values upon which our success depends, honesty and hard work, courage and fair play, tolerance and curiosity, loyalty and patriotism, these things are old. These things are true. They have been the quiet force of progress throughout our history. What is demanded then is a return to these truths. What is required of us now is a new era of responsibility, a recognition on the part of every American that we have duties to ourselves, our nation, and the world, duties that we do not grudgingly accept, but rather seize gladly, firm in the knowledge that there is nothing so satisfying to the spirit, so defining of our character, than giving our all to a difficult task. This is the price and the promise of citizenship. This is the source of our confidence, the knowledge that God calls on us to shape an uncertain destiny. This is the meaning of our liberty and our creed, why men and women and children of every race and every faith can join in celebration across this magnificent mall, and why a man whose father less than 60 years ago might not have been served at a local restaurant can now stand before you to take a most sacred oath. Let us mark this day with remembrance of who we are and how far we have traveled. In the year of America's birth, in the coldest of months, a small band of patriots huddled by dying campfires on the shores of an icy river. The Capitol was abandoned. The enemy was advancing. The snow was stained with blood. At a moment when the outcome of our revolution was most in doubt, the father of our nation ordered these words be read to the people. Let it be told to the future world that in the depth of winter, when nothing but hope and virtue could survive, that the city and the country, alarmed at one common danger, came forth to meet it. America, in the face of our common dangers, in this winter of our hardship, let us remember these timeless words. With hope and virtue, let us brave once more the icy currents and endure what storms may come. Let it be said by our children's children that when we were tested, we refused to let this journey end, that we did not turn back nor did we falter. And with eyes fixed on the horizon and God's grace upon us, we carried forth that great gift of freedom and delivered it safely to future generations. Thank you. God bless you. And God bless the United States of America.
That is Barack Obama's inaugural speech at AM 1500 KSDP, the talk station. We're going to take your reactions if you want. 651-646-8255, toll free 877-615-1500. And we'll be right back.
You are a true blue, dyed-in-the-wool, don't-know-what-the-phrase fair-weather fan means Minnesota Twins supporter. You bleed red, white, and blue with pinstripes. Your cell phone ringtone is, we're gonna win Twins. And in your house, opening day is more important than Christmas. And that's why you're attending the 4th Annual Diamond Awards this Thursday night at the Marriott City Center in Minneapolis. To help celebrate the Twins' 08 season, help fund leading-edge medical research at the U, and mingle with current and former Twins players and coaches. Yeah, you know a real fan wouldn't miss this, and you are a real fan, right? The 4th Annual Diamond Awards. Get all the particulars at am1500.com, keyword events. AM 1500, KSTP.
We just heard the inaugural speech of the new president, Barack Hussein Obama, who took the oath just a little while ago here at AM 1500 KSDP, the talk station. Your reactions, too, after we get through with Bob Berglund's news update, 651-646-8255, toll-free 877-615-1500. Good morning, Mr. Berglund.
Good morning, and here's what happens next. There's kind of a lull in the activities for a while. The president now goes inside the Capitol, where he often issues some executive orders, while President Bush now prepares to leave Washington.
I have to say that he looked happier than I've seen him in some time.
A sense of relief.
He is the happiest guy on the planet right now.
President Obama attends a congressional luncheon inside the Capitol, scheduled for noon, and the parade not scheduled to begin until 1 o'clock our time. The president will ride and or walk in the inaugural parade, which begins at the Capitol and goes along Pennsylvania Avenue to the White House.
All right.
The Fergus Falls High School Band will march in the inauguration parade. Band director Scott Cumrow says they won't be able to see much of today's parade because they're in it and will have to wait in the lineup, but they are pumped up.
The kids are excited. They're ready to go. I haven't seen nerves yet. I'm guessing that I'll probably sink in a little bit tomorrow.
Fergus Band will be about three-quarters of the way into the parade lineup, escorted by the Coast Guard. Yesterday, the group met with Senator Amy Klobuchar in her Washington office. Law enforcement officials, by the way, have already begun closing entrances to the parade route because it is reaching capacity. According to the Mankato Free Press, there's an animal shelter in Fairmont, Minnesota, that has a Portuguese water dog mix up for adoption. And they're hoping it's just the dog the Obamas might want. Yeah. Obama said his family had narrowed down the kind of dog they want to a Labradoodle and a Portuguese water dog, and that they hope to find one at a shelter.
What is a Portuguese water dog? Do you have any idea? I mean, you're a dog guy. Do you know anything about that? What is that? Is it like a terrier or what? You don't know?
No, a family friend had one when we were growing up. And all I remember is that it used to love to run and jump off docks.
Kind of like it Scotty.
It would fly through the air for 20 feet into the water.
Okay.
This one is a mix at the Fairmont Shelter. It was turned in a couple of weeks ago by a family that found it wandering. This dog, when they got it, was named Blackie.
That thing looks like a poodle. It was named Blackie.
At the shelter, they changed its name to Wima, which is Swahili
for God's
kindness
sake.
And compassion.
I'm just going to.
Patrick Hammer's 5 Eyewitness News forecast, partly cloudy and 26 today, 20 overnight.
Looks like a poodle.
Tomorrow up to 35, and Thursday, 34. And then another cold front comes in. By Saturday, our high will only be in the single digits.
Please, President Obama, if you get one of these dogs, do not cut, don't trim their hair down to the scalp with the weird, billowy, please don't make them look like French dogs. Just let them go. Let the hair just grow so they at least can be manly. Right?
Right.
I mean, do you see this picture? We're looking at a picture of this thing.
Yeah.
What's with the shaving of the all the way, and then they don't shave the front part. It's all billowy. It looks, it's not noble. Right? Am I crazy?
Well, that's why they call
him
Fifi and Fufu.
Right, you're right.
16 degrees now at AM 1500 KSTP.
The talk station, AM 1500 KSTP.
All right, there you go. The inaugural speech of the new president, Barack Obama, the 44th president of the United States. And again, this is your chance to respond to it. Again, I have no guests scheduled for today because, other than John Fund and Stephen Moore from the Wall Street Journal editorial board, because I'm tired of the talking heads. I want people to respond to what they heard. I don't know if you can or not. It's very interesting to me. It's funny. While he was speaking, I got the speech, looking at the speech, and then it's a very interesting go-get Reagan speech from the 1980 inaugural. Right? 80, 81. And compare the two. And they're night and day. It's really funny. Reagan says government's not the solution. Obama pretty much says government is the solution. Joan, you're on AM 1500.
The speech was far too long. How long was Reagan's speech?
Longer. Reagan's speech was 2,433 some words. Barack Obama's was like 2,402.
But then it also depends on the delivery, doesn't it?
Well, the idea that Reagan's speech was longer—that's the first thing I thought. And then we looked it up, and if I hadn't looked it up, I would have said the same thing you said. But in fact, they were the same length.
Yeah. You know, I have actually heard him say he's going to rewrite our Constitution.
Where'd you hear him say that?
I don't remember. It was on the radio sometime.
Huh. I don't remember him hearing him say that.
How in the world can you do that?
Well, you'd have to have a constitutional convention in order to do that. And you'd have to call a constitutional convention to do it. You couldn't just rewrite the Constitution.
I know.
That'd be a big deal.
How could he say that?
I don't think he said that. I think, you know, maybe somebody will correct us, but there has been some discussion. There was some discussion last year briefly about a constitutional Congress, but don't hold your breath on that one. You and I will be long gone before they have another one of those.
I hope so. Okay, thank you.
Thanks, Joan. Yeah, let's have a Continental Congress and rewrite the Constitution. I don't think so. What else? This idea that there are indicators of crisis subject to data and statistics, but really what we should be looking at is the nagging fear that we're declining. And again, it's really important right now to think about exactly where we are and what the economic problems are, as opposed to 1980, as opposed to 2000, as opposed to 1933, and so forth, to really get an idea in terms of perspective. When Roosevelt took office, unemployment was 25%. Unemployment is now 7.5%, something like that. It's certainly rising, but it's not 25%. There's a lot of other things to check. I mean, when Reagan took office, inflation was double digits. Unemployment was almost, if not double digits. And in certain states, it was close to it. And interest rates were very high, and there was obviously economic crisis. We have an economic crisis now. I'm not going to deny that. But they want to make it sound really bad. They want to make it sound like it's Valley Forge. And it's important that we think about it in perspective and in focus in terms of what it actually is. Bob, you're on AM 1500.
Hey, I just got done listening to the speech. I thought it was a grown-up speech. I thought the emphasis was on responsibility. I didn't hear the Marxist, we're going to get rid of the Constitution stuff.
I've never said that he intended to do that. I don't know where that comes from. So can you figure out where that idea comes from, that he's going to get rid of the Constitution?
I have no idea where it comes from. I thought there was an emphasis on capitalism, and I thought it was a great speech. It reminded me a little bit of Clinton.
Thanks, Bob. I appreciate it. So there's a positive review of the Obama speech. Good. Sully, you're on AM 1500.
Yeah. What I got out of it was I was sensing fear, and not necessarily the fear that he was saying that the American public should have for all the bad things that were going on. But I think that he was actually afraid to a certain extent of having to take on this mantle of being president. You could just... There was faltering. There were things in his voice and his inflections that were very nervous, and a lot of downplaying of what the government could actually do when he...
Well, that would be wise, considering the expectations that are carried with him into office.
Exactly.
It's interesting to me because...
I think he's very afraid.
I wouldn't say that he's afraid. I would say that he is carrying that weight. You know, it's interesting because... I thought the same thing. I didn't think fear. I just thought he really is. He's taken this all in, and as he's taken it in, he's thinking, what have I got myself into?
Right.
You know what I mean?
You can only wish him the best, but I mean, wow, you know. And so now he's trying to downplay it. I think he's worried that he's gonna go down in history, maybe as well. He's obviously going down in history, but as a failure. As someone that was supposed to be the best, and now all of a sudden it's just overwhelming.
Well, he's only been president for about 42 minutes, so I don't know if that. I think that will change. I think he'll bear up under it, and as time goes on, he'll get used to the office, and he'll be okay with it because he's had to. You have to. I mean, the kind of person who actually runs for president and goes through the whole campaigning and goes through the process, you can't, that sort of prepares you for the office. And I realize that no one can prepare a person for office. I sense a nervousness. I wouldn't call it fear, but nervousness.
Well, you know, but one of the things is, though, is that you have to, I don't know, nervousness, yes, trepidation, maybe. Maybe fear is a little harsh, but I mean, there was a sense of it that, you know, what used to be the doom and gloom is now just kind of like, oh my God, I have it.
The doom and gloom coming from which direction?
Well, that's what I'm saying. We've been getting the doom and gloom from the media forever, and he's always been trying to be the upbeat dude, and now all of a sudden he's doing this little doom and gloom bit. I don't know who's running who.
Well, you haven't been listening to his speeches then, because he's been doing the doom and gloom since day one, that
we have all these terrible problems. That's what I'm saying, but I mean, at least at this point, when he was supposed to be doing an uplifting thing, he didn't.
Well, the philosophy is not uplifting. The philosophy is things are really bad and we're going to step in and save you. The exact opposite of Reagan's first inaugural, which was,
yep.
I think he said something to the effect of, I am here to tell you that the problems that you have are, the government is not the solution. What Obama is saying is
the government is
the solution. And if it is, great, but many of us do not agree with that. That is the real question. Do we expand or contract the government? I joked with Stephen Moore there. You know, we spent 35 years getting rid of the government, and now we're going to get it. It's all coming back.
But don't you think that puts a little bit of an onus on him when he is saying that the government is a solution and he's going to find out that it isn't?
No,
I think that might cause a little fear and trepidation.
No, I think what causes the fear and trepidation is you go in there, you walk through these hallowed hallways. This is a great, pomp and circumstance of a ceremony, the hail to the chief. It's for real. You put your hand on the Bible. You swear to God. You're standing up there, and now you're the president of the United States, a job in which, as was it Truman that said, Ike's going to come in here, and as a general, he's used to having people obey his orders, and he's going to sit down and he's going to pick up the telephone and call somebody and tell them to do something, and virtually nothing is going to happen. It is a political office, and I think, if anything, I don't think it was fear so much. It's like he's accepting the burden of that. But it's interesting because I had the same reaction. There was a difference in his tone this time as opposed to the speech he made in Chicago when he accepted the election.
Oh, yes, and I guess that's what I'm saying. I don't know if fear was the right word, but, I mean, I don't know if nervousness is exactly it either. I don't know exactly
what it
is.
We'll see. Thanks, Sully. I appreciate it. Mike, you're on AM 1500.
Yeah, I think it's not necessarily fear. It's just a different perspective, kind of like when a dog finally catches up to the car. They have a different perspective on what it's going to be like.
Yeah, now he's got to do it.
What's that?
Now he's got to do it.
Yep. He caught the car.
Thanks, Mike.
All right.
Yeah, and he'll do it. I didn't sense fear. I just sensed that it must be an awesome thing to want to be president, to have wanted to be president for a long time, to have fought for it, worked for it, pushed for it, tried to get all the people that you have to get together to do it, to inspire your campaign, to run your campaign, to win the primaries, to win the nomination, to go out and win the election. To go through that whole process of the transition where you're waiting, 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 and then to step out there in the sunshine and accept the Bible and take the oath, he was nervous. And I think anybody would be nervous to take that thing. So I don't sense that it was fear so much as it was that. What I think is interesting about the speech is that there really are a few specifics in the speech. There was, if you compare it with Reagan's speech, for example, in which he specifically stated the problems and the solutions, there was a lot, again, this symbolic language, almost like a sermon of what is, it's almost like girding the nation's loins as opposed to, here are the things we have to do. And it's a difference in style. I'm not saying it means anything, but it's 28 years later, it's literally night and day if you look at the speeches. Tom, you're on AM 1500.
Bob, I know it's probably not a big deal, but I noticed at the beginning of the speech he said, instead of fellow Americans, like most, if not all presidents have said in the past, he said fellow citizens. Maybe his, reaching out to the rest of the world kind of a thing, you know, the speech was to everyone. Is that why you think, did you notice that he said fellow citizens and not fellow Americans?
I didn't notice that. I noticed the flubbing of the actual oath.
Yeah.
That was the big thing.
I'll let him slide on that one.
No, me too.
I think he's going to get a little
flack on that.
A little flack from that.
Thank you, fellow citizen. It's
right.
Time for us to go because we must head to the pavilion. So we have to go down and prepare for the inauguration doctrinal ceremonies. KSTP St. Paul, Minneapolis, The Talk Station. Denny Schaefer is next.